Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona, Rebecca, we are back. And I know a couple weeks ago we had this episode about sue the bastards, and it sounded a little brash, but I know we were hinting that we would certainly have an update on that. What's been happening?
Well, Mark, they did sue. In fact, there isn't one lawsuit going on in the industry right now, but two. And I can tell you, everybody is excited and the tension is there. Right, Rebecca?
I would say, yeah, I think more the
excited?
Tension rather than being excited.
those being sued, I'm sure, are excited as well. So it basically, it took a blog post and a podcast episode, and now everyone's like, yeah, let's sue.
Well, there's a lot more than that. And quite frankly, you know, there's complications both if the lawsuit goes ahead and even if whichever side wins, there is a complication. So we thought the best in the industry needs to come and explain it to our listeners.
You're certainly right, Mona, and we do need some help in exploring this topic. So we have joining us on today's show, John Pratt. John, welcome back to EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Love to be here and then discuss this very important issue and these two litigations that are extremely important for the industry.
John, you know, a lot of people understand that you guys do an awful lot in immigration, but I really don't know if the listeners and people out there understand just what a voice you both have, you and Ira.
Yes, well, we've been involved in immigration litigation for a long time. I mean, I've been with Ira for 20 years already, and
time flies.
Yeah, and we're doing litigation all the time, and Ira before that. So, you know, Ira was one of the first and initial, obviously, immigration litigators suing or litigating in a host issue in a number of different issues in immigration, from asylum to removal defense. Obviously, our firm litigated the only circuit court precedent decision to date in EB5 in the Chang decision when they changed the regulations back in 98. So we've been involved in all aspects of litigation and, in immigration, a lot of litigation in the EB5 context. I mentioned Chang, but we did also class actions on the loan proceeds. For example, we did a derivative litigation to try to argue that, you know, derivatives were not covered. And we led to a lot of success in a lot of cases settled or ultimately we won in the courts related to different aspects and different policies, obviously related to EB5. So we have a lot of experience in the litigation arena.
Hey, Rebecca, I knew there was a reason that they're our go-to people.
I know. I feel like a baby talking to John on this topic.
Thank you for your kindness.
All right, John. So we have these two lawsuits, which are currently and before federal court. And of course, yesterday, it was a big day. Yesterday being June 2nd, there was a hearing for one of the Behring cases. But just before we get into that, could you just tell us the difference between the two lawsuits which are now attacking USCIS?
The two lawsuits are premised on the Administrative Procedures Act because USCIS took an action and announced that all regional centers basically had been terminated or were no longer designated because of the repeal of 610 and the creation of the new law. Before these lawsuits, though, IUSA, as one of the leading organizations in the industry, sent a letter to USCIS asking them for an attestation type format whereby regional centers could file an attestation type application and they would be designated to be allowed to file new petitions going forward under the new law. And basically, the agency did not follow that procedure and unilaterally said that they created a form whereby it has to be filed and that has to be adjudicated before a regional center could be designated under the new law.
Yeah, I remember, John, when we had that meeting at the IAUSA conference and us discussing what should go into these forms. And like you said, IUSA did write a letter hoping for just maybe something simpler, you know, an attestation, as we were saying, just to say the regional centers that were already are previously designated maybe doesn't have to go through such a long process to get redesignated under this new law. And I think that did not come out. We saw new forms and, you know, is the fair of how long is this going to take?
Yeah, but before the new forms, though, John, there was an attempt, right, at getting other congressmen involved to try and sway USCIS?
There were a few congressmen that have said that the new law did not require all regional centers to basically be redesignated through a long, drawn-out process because that creates certain tensions in the industry. How long does it take for a new regional center to be designated and the timing, meaning if a regional center gets designated before another one, there's a competitive advantage in the marketplace because creates certain tensions. But let's just back up a little bit because one of the issues that I raised at that meeting with IUSA is what happens with regional centers that do not want to file new petitions? They do not want to continue, you know, being regional centers and sponsoring projects. They just want to finish what they have. So I think IUSA correctly pointed out that whoever wants to continue sponsoring projects could file an attestation type format. And attestations are allowed in other aspects of immigration law in the labor certification context, whereby you file an attestation that you're doing all the compliance features of the new law. And if USCIS would like to audit or inquire further, they could do that. But upon filing of the attestation, the regional center is designated and allowed to obviously file a business plan and attempt to file new I-526s pursuant to new projects.
Well, John, if the regional centers go that route, is there any benefit to them in doing so?
That would eliminate the adjudication time period and would eliminate any competitive advantage by having one regional center being approved for a project before others, because obviously that would be a considerable advantage in the marketplace that, you know, you're the first one getting approved and otherwise are lagging behind to seek approval.
Right. So the first regional center to really go and sue, and I feel like they just felt they didn't have a choice, was the Bering Regional Center. And that's significant because Bering was so successful a year ago in reducing the and getting rid of the regulations, which reduced the amount from 900,000 back to 500,000.
Correct. The lawsuit regarding the regulations was excellent. It followed other lawsuits in other areas of immigration law where Chad Wolf was not properly appointed, and all those regulations were eventually struck down. So it did follow a line of cases in immigration litigation where they didn't follow the proper procedures to back the regulation. But specifically as to this lawsuit, basically what the lawsuit in Bering, and similarly now that the other lawsuit, obviously that was filed by IUSA and different regional centers, including EB5 Capital, they're challenging the announcement of USCIS saying all regional centers are basically terminated based on the repeal of 610 of the old law. And in order to allow or be allowed to do new projects, they have to file this form. The form has to be adjudicated and approved. And then after that happens, then you can go ahead and file further additional documentation to try to get the projects approved before you can have investors file new I-526s.
So, John, let me just ask you. So, you know, for a layperson listening, they were like, okay, this makes sense considering that the new law is there to give integrity measures and make sure that each regional center is doing what it's supposed to do. So maybe they're just not understanding why all the regional centers are upset about this. I think it comes down to two words, economic hardship.
Well, and that's what the lawsuits are arguing, that they're being harmed by USCIS's interpretation. Now, there is one senator that has said that the law was designed that way, Senator Grassley. Obviously, he's made some of those comments outside of the, you know, legislative record. But his view is all regional centers are basically defunct as of their repeal, and they must be designated under a new procedure. But other senators who were present when that law got enacted have said that that was not the purpose, because let's remember the period for enactment of this section was 60 days after it passed on March 15. And if USCIS then takes out a long process to adjudicate these petitions, then in essence, they've killed the EB-5 regional center program for many more months. And part of this litigation has argued that there were pending, 924s pending sometimes for months or years. And depending on the number of regional centers that will be seeking redesignation, that could take a long time. And they're also highlighting this problem of timing on adjudications and unfair advantages or disadvantages, depending on who gets approved the quickest.
Right.
Well, you're saying right, Mona, obviously agreeing with the accuracy of John's statement. But John, tell us, what is this going to do to the EB-5 industry? Who's reacting and how would they react?
So obviously it's frustrating, and that's part of the argument. It's frustrating the intent of the new legislation, because it doesn't allow for a regional center program for new filings for many, many more months, if not years. And obviously it causes hardship to this specific regional centers that have projects that could be funded and could be filed under EB-5, but they are not allowed to go forward with those. And again, if it was an attestation, for example, in other contexts, you said I'm doing all these things. And that's what an attestation is. I'm complying with all these new features of the law of compliance. And you could file that as an attestation if the government then wants to vet. If you are really doing it, there's procedures in other immigration functions where that happens. You get audited. And then you submit the documentation at that point in time, or there's a request to submit the documentation to back up your attestations that you're complying with those, these new safety protocols.
Well, yesterday was terribly exciting. this hearing in front of Judge Chhabra, and I believe it's in the Northern District of California, he actually said, and I'm going to quote, Judge Chhabra called it a stretch that Congress plainly intended for RCs to continue to be authorized. But he felt that the statute was silent and ambiguous. And then he even went as far to say that, quote, the agency may have committed legal error by being too quick to assume the language of the Integrity Act means that Congress requires us to treat all RCs as having been deauthorized.
Correct. Obviously, I think, like I said, initially, it was unknown how they were going to apply it. That's why USA suggested, why don't we do an attestation if we want to go forward? Because if, and let me just mention this, because I think it's important that the lawsuits are, I believe they're completely merited, that there's a lot of merit in the arguments that they've raised under the APA, notice and comment, and other of the challenges that they're having. But USCIS also took a favorable position to some investors, and that was on question 6 in the Q&A that was issued in April, where they talked about, can I establish eligibility of my pre-enactment Form I-526 petition, even though previously approved regional center associated with my petition is no longer designated?
John, could you give us an example, perhaps a hypothetical situation that you foresee this could play out?
That could apply in a couple of contexts. Let me talk about one context. In a regional center that had not been terminated previous to the repeal, but they were going through the process of termination. Now, according to how they answered this Q&A, they said, well, the repeal of the Immigrant Investor Program requires previously designated centers to reapply for designation if they wish to continue participation. The need to reapply does not impact petitions pending prior to March 15, 2022. What that means is, what happens if the process of terminating had commenced, but the regional center was not terminated? The way that I read that answer is those I-526s will be adjudicated irrespective of the regional center. They will be adjudicated to determine whether funds were properly used and jobs properly created. Also, what happens if a regional center doesn't want to seek designation because they're not interested in filing new cases?
Well, I can tell you, John, that at least, and it's not just me, there's a number of other attorneys who have said this, at least 60%, at least, of our current regional center clients don't want to do that. And they all have projects and they have clients who are waiting, a lot of them from China, who are going to be there a long time before they get their 526s, let alone the 829s. Now what happens?
Correct. And I think this is the one, and I mentioned this to one of the counsels for one of these lawsuits, that this is a tension. Obviously, I represent investors. I represented some regional centers too. I don't know whether they're interested in going forward or not. At this point, they haven't indicated either way. But the bottom line is this. If all regional centers, if the lawsuits succeed that all regional centers that were not terminated are still designated, then immigration has to go through a process of terminating some of them, whether they want to continue or not. I don't know if that's enough basis under the old law. It was to terminate it because they were not pursuing economic interest anymore. So that could have an effect on all of the grandfather I-526 petitions that do no longer need an affiliation to be adjudicated. And, you know, obviously, if it was repealed, you can't terminate a regional center anymore under 610 because it was repealed. So there may be some winners and some losers. Obviously, the winners are clearly the regional centers that had grandfather petitions and will be continuing. But what happens to those investors, obviously, and in regional centers that do not want to go forward if all regional centers are considered to be designated and must file an I-956? What happens if you don't? And then you're going to be terminated. Then they're going to go kick in under that new provision that if they're terminated, they give you 180 days to switch. So I think there's some unanswered questions, again, on the reach of this litigation.
Well, John, I know new information is coming in, but there are still some unanswered questions, as you said. But knowing what you know now and believing what you think the intent of the direction that things are going, are there any recommendations you would make?
I think, obviously, the IUSA initial thought of having a regional center that wants to go forward in an attestation-type format would be the way to go, because if you don't want to go forward, then you don't file the attestation. And then your investor gets adjudicated under the law existing at that point in time. And under that policy, protecting investors that USCIS announced in the Q&A on April, they would be adjudicated solely in relation to the use of the funds and how those funds created the jobs, not by being affiliated with a regional center any longer.
But John, the new law does allow investors to switch regional centers should a regional center be terminated. So maybe USCIS could just argue that they could just, all these investors could affiliate with another regional center for their IA-29s or whatever is left to be done. Don't you think that would work?
But let's think about it. It's true, Mona, in the sense that even an affiliation is allowed and they retract from their current policy, these regional centers are going to want to know what type of projects they are. And there's going to be a fee associated with an affiliation with a regional center. I do not believe the regional centers will be doing this on a pro bono basis.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Under the current policy, if you look at question six, it clearly says, despite the previously approved regional center associated with your petition no longer being designated, you may still establish eligibility by demonstrating compliance with other applicable requirements. So if they retract from that, based on the lawsuit, then again, there may be some winners, but they may be some losers.
So basically, it leaves the investors kind of in the middle again. Whereas if, like John, like you said, if this happens and they have to go, like, who's responsible finding a new regional center? You know, it would be much easier if they have that one sheet of paper, attest to it. If they don't want to move forward, then at least your I-829 can still get adjudicated. If we have to, you know, go back and look for new regional centers, it's like, whose responsibility is it?
Yeah. And then the other thing is that many a time it's the regional center who has the relationship with the job creating entity, the actual project. There's
yes.
not a lot of projects out there which are doing it on their own. And if they're doing it there on their own, they're not likely to, you know, not to go forward with their investors. So I think that connection and severing that connection would be detrimental for clients, for investors rather. And the whole idea of the Integrity Act is to enhance the EB-5 program for investors. At this rate, and I think this was argued in maybe the second lawsuit, that at this rate, they're deregulating billions of dollars coming into the U.S. rather than regulating it.
No, correct. I mean, I think that there's a lot of merit in these lawsuits. They're very well grounded. Obviously, I don't believe USCIS followed proper procedures in their policies and went through notice and comment and all the other requirements.
Well, we were shocked at the speed that form came out. We really didn't expect it.
Yeah, there is a provision under the law that exempted on the speed that they have to do some things because there has to be compliance with certain reporting requirements when you do forms. But there was an exemption under the law for about a year. But having said that, and my understanding of or my recollection of some of the hearings that transpired in the Baring lawsuit is that there was a discussion of whether the new law was really protecting investors and regional centers or protecting investors at the expense of regional centers, et cetera. And I think there's a tension there. But the bottom line is this, at least how USCIS has indicated that they're going to be applying the law, especially in the grandfathering provisions of people that had filed, because Rebecca, it's not just I-29s who get the benefit, it's I-526s. And I have investors in projects that were untainted, but they were part of a regional center that had tainted projects. And they were seeking to terminate the regional center. And under the old provisions, the regional centers could not move to a new, you know, the project could not move to a new one. And even if they could, there was substantial amounts of money that new regional centers wanted in order to have an affiliation. And under this policy that they announced specifically, again, I go back to question six, you don't have to have an affiliation and you can still have your I-526 adjudicated if you prove that your money was properly used and it created the proper jobs. Well, if none of the regional centers have been, you know, expired because of their repeal and they're all still designated and they don't file, what is the immigration going to do then? Then terminate them because they didn't file the 956? I think I would love for the lawsuits to succeed on behalf of the regional centers and allow EB-5 to go forward, because otherwise it will harm the industry going forward. But I would hope that the protections that have been afforded to the investors of grandfather I-526 petitions continue to also be applied by USCIS and not forcing to have some sort of affiliation with either a regional center that could have been terminated previously, but there were not, or a regional center that doesn't want to file a 956.
Well, John, we're looking for a perfect world in that one. But I think what a lot of frustration we've seen as well with these forms is that as soon as they came out, you know, people were prepared, filed, and then we've seen some rejections from USCIS. Have you seen that?
I've heard that. I've heard, you know, I haven't filed one prospectively. I've also heard, for example, that they've been accepted and there's no receipt number, et cetera. I'll simply say this, you know, and I've said it in a couple of panels that I've spoken, that USCIS is having problems issuing employment authorization documents. It takes 12 months. So for us to expect, and this is why I think the litigation is critical, for us to expect that they were going to get these forms correct and timely, and they're going to be timely adjudicated, I think that they've expressed in one of these lawsuits 180 days, I think it's hopeful or illusional at best. So regional centers that are interested in going forward, they should have an attestation upon filing, whether it's a 956 that does that attestation or whatever mechanism USCIS ultimately, and maybe through the litigation, is forced to accept. But I would hope that USCIS still takes the policy position that a regional center that does not want to file an attestation 9526 and is not interested in filing new cases, that those investors are still protected irrespective of an affiliation to a 610 or repeal regional center under 610, and they have no interest in going forward under the new law.
John, do you think that there could be a settlement possibility, perhaps with an attestation, or do you think there's anything additional that either a lawsuit could add or do?
Yeah, I mean, there's always, I thought, and maybe I misunderstood that, but I thought that there was some comment on the hearing in Baring that the judge was at least mentioned, what if I allow it on Baring? Because these are not done as class
action. I was just going to bring that up. Yeah.
And we were like, no, not just for one regional center.
Well, but let's remember one thing. These were not done as class action.
Yeah.
These were done as plaintiffs. So...
Sorry, John, what does that mean, though, for our listener? What difference would it have been made?
Well, they do say in both other lawsuits that I read that all regional centers are still designated or effective or not defunct. So they are mentioning all the regional centers. But I did not see that they were asking for class certification. So there's a plaintiff. And could that settlement be done with a plaintiff? Yeah, if the government wants to settle with them, they could. Does that bind everybody else? Not necessarily. It depends on the settlement.
Maybe that's why the five regional centers that came with IOUSA, they're bringing another lawsuit. Does that mean to say that others will also bring a lawsuit?
It could be others. And I think there was a mention, though, in the Bering lawsuit that if the Bering lawsuit, you know, if relief is granted to everybody, that the second lawsuit, you know, may not be necessary because they're both seeking one and the same thing, to be honest with you, at the end of the day. They're in different courts, but to me, they're both, you know, challenging the USCIS's website announcement that all regional centers were defunct. When they made that announcement, they had not expressed, or to my recollection, they had not expressed that grandfather investors may be okay if their money was properly used and the jobs were properly created.
You think they should have had that in the lawsuit?
I'm sorry?
Do you think they should have added that into the lawsuit?
No, because I think that what they're saying is all regional centers are still designated. The lawsuits are arguing that all regional centers are designated. They're looking at it from the perspective of the regional center, not the investor.
Well, Judge Chopra had, I was asking a lot of the right questions because all of this issue about pulling up about the fact that if USCIS are stating that the regional center program was defunct as of June of last year, then why were they still adjudicating 829s and asking for the filings on 924s? Here's another thing, John. This is not a small amount of money. I know, for immigration purposes, it's a huge amount of money in comparison to the other areas. And USCIS is asking, they're deliberately bringing different forms for different areas. You're looking at about $60,000 just in filing fees.
Mm-hmm. It's devastating to the regional centers that want to go forward, clearly. I mean, the regional centers do not want to go forward. They still have a fiduciary duty to assist the investors until they complete the process. So I don't think it just disappears. But I think, obviously, the lawsuits are done by the regional centers. Obviously, they do represent investors, but they're done by the regional centers because, you know, especially the regional centers that are the plaintiffs, obviously, they have investors that were pending that their grandfather, and they want to have new investors file. So they'll be able to cover both of those. But we're talking about your clients, for example, Mona, or the regional centers do have no incentive to go forward
or will not.
Or the regional centers that USCIS had started the process of terminating them, but they did not terminate it. I don't believe that USCIS can if USCIS is right that it was repealed, how could they terminate a regional center when they have no law to repeal it?
So, yeah, that's true.
So they're protected. So what happens if Bering and Daywin and none of the regional centers were lost designation? Well, then all of them will be required to file an attestation or something later to file new petitions. And even if they are allowed to file new I-526s, those I-526s will have to be adjudicated. But what happens if a regional center decides not to file any new I-526s?
You bring up a good point, John. Are they going to go through the process of terminating those regional centers? I don't know. What do you think, Mona?
Yeah, you know, John, Mark, Rebecca, today is June 3rd. We had this hearing before Judge Chopra yesterday, June 2nd, and he has ordered both sides to produce briefs on by Monday. You know, pity those lawyers, they don't have a weekend. But by the time we have this podcast episode aired, we might have a decision, though I doubt it. What do you think, John?
Well, I think obviously the judge is going to take the briefing has to be submitted on Monday or something to that effect, and he will be issuing a ruling shortly thereafter. I do hope, my hope is that for all the regional centers that are interested in going forward, there's a simple mechanism whereby upon filing, they continue to be designated and allowed to file new petitions, but at the same time protecting, obviously, the regional centers that will not be seeking to file anything because they are not interested in filing any petitions going forward. And obviously, as the declaration for Alyssa Mel, the chief of the IPO, indicated in the Bering lawsuit, USCIS has been adjudicating those I-526s, even though they took the position that there was no designated regional center affiliated with those petitions. I do hope that whatever settlement or whatever ultimate conclusion arrives protects the regional centers that want to go forward eliminates any disadvantages in inconsistent adjudication timelines and otherwise by USCIS. And just upon filing, they continue to be designated, even if it's just a simple, I want to be designated, because I think the reality is that some regional centers will not be seeking any further designations whatsoever because they're not interested in filing any further petitions for a variety of reasons. Some of them were in trouble already. Yeah. And some of them are not interested in being under all these requirements. And some of them had foreign ownership.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. Yes.
So I do hope that at the end, the result of these lawsuits protect the regional centers, as the both lawsuits correctly pointed out. And protecting the regional centers and EB-5 going forward is critical. But also remembering to afford the grandfather protections of the petitions that have been pending, that's not eliminated also as a result of the settlement or the final solution or resolution of these lawsuits.
Obviously, there is still a lot to consider. Things are still changing. We've got a little bit more details now, but we expect more details in the future, in the next week or so. And I'm sure we're going to have an update for our listeners right here on EB-5 Investment Voice. Until then, John Pratt, thank you so much for joining us on today's episode and sharing with us your insight and expertise.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.